This evening. Let me encourage you to find your way there if you haven't found your way already. In the early chapters of Isaiah, it's setting the stage for what's coming. Some of the things to remember is Isaiah is sometimes, and you'll see it this evening as well, speaks about a future event in the past tense as if it's already happened. That's not unique to Isaiah. Sometimes prophets would do that. They would speak about a future event in the past tense because it, in the mind of God, it had already taken place. And so you'll find that from time to time. The northern kingdom has already collapsed under the weight of the Assyrian Empire. And the southern kingdom is watching and somewhat fearful that the same fate may happen to them. However, there's been kind of a lull in the activity of the Assyrians, at least in Israel, or that part of the world. So things were pretty good when Isaiah is prophesying, at least early on. However, there is a foreboding of what's going to take place. God's people are in rebellion. It's not that they're not worshiping God. They are, but they're also in rebellion against God. They're under the false illusion that they can offer their sacrifices, go through the different feast days and those kind of things, and God is okay with however they live. But their religious experiences were not translating into how they would live every single day. And they were not just in a state of rebellion against God over and over again. And we're going to find that echoed once again in chapter 5. When we get to chapter 6, perhaps next week, that's when we have the account of Isaiah's call to ministry, as it were, to become a prophet. And that's when he has the vision in the temple. And we'll talk more about that when we get there. This one, though, begins with a particular, somewhat of a, not exactly a parable, but a comparison of God's people, Israel, to a vineyard. Something very vividly familiar to those who lived at that time in Israel. A vineyard would be one of the major crops, if I could call it that, that you would find there. And so he's going to do that. And this particular vineyard account is also echoed in the New Testament. You may be familiar with John chapter 15, where Jesus is talking about, I am the vine, you are the branches. It's got the vineyard motif about it. And there's some other places where that vineyard is spoken of. Jesus, in one of his parables, talks about the vineyard. And so you can understand in the New Testament, somewhat in the background is this particular passage. So we can begin now by looking at verse 1. I will sing about the one I love, a song about my loved one's vineyard, or well-loved person. And at this point, it seems to be the prophet himself speaking. I will sing about the one I love, the well-loved one. A song about my loved one's vineyard. The one I love had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He broke up the soil, he cleared it of stones, and planted it with the finest vines. He built a tower in the middle of it and dug out a wine press there. He expected it to yield good grapes, but it yielded worthless grapes. So you see, as he's couching this, you get the idea that, of course, it's going to be clear that the vineyard represents God's people. God has done everything necessary for the people to flourish and thrive. He's done all that is necessary for that to occur, and yet they do not produce good fruit. They do not produce good grapes. They produce rather worthless grapes. I remember down in the hills growing up, we had two variety of wild grapes. they're both a little bit on the tart side. But one particular kind of grape, it looks something like a Concord grape, but they're much smaller. And as a kid, I'd crawl up in a tree that had grapevine in it, and I would spend half a day up there just eating grapes. You know, pretty good. That's one of the species of grapes down there. But there's another species of grapes down there. We call them possum grapes. Much smaller. And you could not eat very many of those. They were so tart, so sour. And even at this time of the year, you would still find those grapes in the woods. Animals would eat them. And we would try to eat them, but we couldn't eat very many of them because after a while you get a bellyache. I mean, they're just that way. But the thing that when I read this passage, I think of like that. He's expecting these nice, beautiful grapes, full of juice, perfect. And he ends up with possum grapes. They're not useful for anything. They're worthless. So now, verse 3, we're switching gears a bit. So now, residents of Jerusalem, men of Judah, please judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I did? Why, when I expected a yield of good grapes, did it yield worthless grapes? Now I will tell you that I'm about to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will tear down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland. It will not be pruned or weeded. Thorns and briars will grow up. I will also give orders to the clouds that rain should not fall on it. For the vineyard of the Lord is the house of Israel and the men of Judah. The plant he delighted in, he judged, expected justice, and he saw injustice. He expected righteousness, but heard cries of despair. So you see the image first, followed by the clarification about exactly what the vineyard is representing, the people. So what you have there is that comparison to help us understand with more clarity what was going on. For example, he expected good grapes. He did everything necessary for the good grapes to flourish. Comparatively speaking, he did everything necessary for his people to flourish. He brought them from slavery into a land flowing with milk and honey. They lived in houses they did not build. They were able to glean crops they did not plant. They were able to experience those kind of things. They were in a land that they were enabled, that was going to be a blessing to them. God did everything necessary. But then what do you have? He expected to find justice, but what did he find? Injustice. He expected to find righteousness, but what did he find instead? Cries of despair. The kind of cries of despair are usually a reference to, and here, no doubt, a reference to the poor that are being oppressed by their fellow Jews. Now, it's a good time for me to stop and take a moment to reflect on our own culture today about the whole idea of justice. You need to understand some things. And at least get, and not a long diatribe on this, but I want you to understand the difference between biblical justice and what we might call today social justice. Okay? There is a major difference. Justice is basically treating people fairly, just. But when you translate it into our day, when you talk about critical race theory, intersectionality, critical theory itself, you find something that's totally different than that. You find something that is not working justly across the board. You will find something that certain groups... Has anybody ever watched the cartoon Animal Farm? You know what I'm talking about? Well, it's 1984, the novel, 1984, put in a cartoon form. The setting, of course, is a farm. And there's kind of a statement in there, and the pig was kind of the one in charge of everything. He was the Marxist leader. He was the big brother, so to speak. And he said, all animals are equal, just some are more equal than others. That's kind of what we're talking about in some senses when we talk about critical race theory. It's everybody's equal, but some people are more equal than others. But basically what they've done is they call it more, some people are more oppressed than others. And I try to be sympathetic towards some of the experiences of people who are proponents of this. I just find myself getting kind of fatigued listening to their drivel. And I know that sounds pretty harsh, especially the Caucasian, the white woke people. Like I wonder, what are you talking about? I mean, literally, what are you talking about? With this whole idea of systemic racism. I mean, you don't have to be overtly racist, but you're part of a racist system, so thereby you're guilty of being a racist, even though you're not a racist. A person or a couple that adopt black children are still considered racist, and an African American person. this is how bizarre this stuff gets. Even an African American person who rejects critical race theory being legitimate, they are basically a white supremacist. You work that one out. It ends up not even. Yes, people should be treated fairly, justly, righteously, whomever they are. However, you can't, when you divide people up into groups, I'll tell you exactly what you're doing. You're doing violence to what the Scripture has already revealed. So Christians who are on the bandwagon of this need to realize that they are actually working in opposition to what the Scripture teaches. In Galatians, Paul says, there is neither rich or poor, free or slave, male or female, but all are one in Christ. Now you start dividing people up, you don't have that. You will not have that unity. So it's important that, and there's a lot more we can go there, but the kind of justice they're talking about here is not what we're hearing today. It's not Black Lives Matter. It's not the systemic racism. It's not all of these kinds of things. This wokeness that is penetrating so many areas of our culture. It's simply not going to bring a resolution to any kind of problems. It's just not going to do it. And even things like a traditional nuclear family, husband, wife, and children, is, for some, an example of systemic racism. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. Anyway, so there's supposed to be justice. People being treated justly and fairly. But they weren't. Not all of them were. The poor were being oppressed. They were being taken advantage of by those who had the power to take advantage of them. And that is something that you will find the prophets speaking about and to in many cases. Then we move into the next paragraph or the next section, and we're going to move to six woes. Six woes, six warnings about the kind of culture that was prevalent in Judah. The first woe begins in verse 8. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room and you are alone and left in the land. The idea of consuming more and more for yourself. If you took more and more land, more and more fields, more and more property, you would be pushing out others. Now, wait a minute. Don't start thinking along the socialist terms, because that's not the idea here. Do you remember back when Joshua led the children of Israel into the promised land, into Canaan? Each tribe was given an allotment of land, with the exception of the tribe of Levi, the priestly tribe. They were given a section, a given territory in which to live. Now, theoretically, a family would be given a section of that, and it would be theirs forever. The whole idea of the Sabbath rest, or the year of Jubilee, was built into the system, supposed to, where you could guard against people being able to gobble up because of hard times at the land of other people. Matter of fact, the year of Jubilee, what was to happen is the land was to revert back to the original owners. Every 50th year, the land was to revert back to whoever had it to begin with. The issue a lot of this has to do with the importance of property rights. Example. We kind of wonder about this particular provision that is in the law of Moses. The provision basically is this. If a young man marries a young woman and he dies before they have children, the brother of the deceased is to marry the widow. So he is to marry his sister-in-law. And any children born are not considered his children. They're his deceased brother's children. Now that sounds odd, doesn't it? Until you understand the importance of property rights. The brother's allotment of property is still in their family. It's not someone else going to gobble it up. You also had the goel, and that's not a ghoul, like, you know, this time of year talking about something scary. A goel is a kinsman redeemer. And there was always to be that provision made that if, say for example, a father dies, the patriarch, his eldest son gets the majority of the inheritance. But he gets more than just that. He also inherits a responsibility for the entire clan, the family, that family unit. So he says he's got a younger brother, and he's reckless. And he borrows too much money. He can't pay it back. Well, and maybe he'll end up being a servant or something to pay that debt off. I mean, that was one of the options available that they would sometimes do. Or maybe his particular allotment of the inheritance is taken because of the debt that he owes. Well, the older brother, he could redeem what was taken. Redeem the debt, as it were, of the younger brother. He could redeem it. Do you remember when Naomi and Ruth came back to the Bethlehem area? There was a man named, what was his name?
Boaz.
Naomi told Ruth what to do. And she does it. And Boaz, he has to first, there's a relative closer in relation to Naomi than Boaz is. So he had to go and give the option of redemption to the other relative. And he said, well, I've already got a wife. I don't need another one. You take her. That's a loose paraphrase. You don't look at me so serious. Anyway, so he does. He redeems Naomi. And of course, by virtue, Ruth, too. He redeems her. He's the Goel. And that's important that you see. Hosea. Remember that lovely woman he married? Gomer? I cannot say that name.
without thinking about Gomer Pyle. Right?
Always have. There's Gomer. She is not a good wife. Matter of fact, she becomes a very promiscuous, she was a harlot. And when she, and during that process, Hosea divorces her. And then, when she is about as low as she could possibly be, he goes, because God instructs him to do this, he goes to where she's going to be sold as a slave. And what does he do? He buys her back. He buys, he is being the Goel. He's buying her back. You see that? So that's why the property rights are so important. But here you see, people that had means and the ability were extending their property at the expense of other people. And they weren't observing the year of Jubilee. They just weren't. I heard the Lord say, indeed, many houses will become desolate, grand and lovely ones without inhabitants. For a 10-acre vineyard will be only 6 gallons of wine, and 10 bushels of seed will yield only 1 bushel of grain. That's the first woe. You see that God is judging not only the people, but the land. What's going to happen? The next woe, verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning and pursue beer, who linger into the evening inflamed by wine. At their feasts they have the lyre, the harp, the tambourine, flute, and wine. They do not perceive the Lord's actions. They do not see the work of His hands. He's talking about the abuse of alcohol. The abuse to the place that they're not even perceiving what God is doing. They don't even have a clue because they're intoxicated by their pursuit of strong drink. Next, therefore my people will go into exile because they lack knowledge. Her dignitaries are starving and her masses are parched with thirst. Therefore my people will go into exile. Why? Because they lack knowledge. What kind of knowledge do they lack? What is it? What are we talking about? Do they not have any engineers or any doctors? Do they not have any... what is it?
They don't know.
They don't have a knowledge of the Holy One of Israel. They don't. They don't realize that. It's a very sobering passage when you're reading the book of Judges. When you're reading the book of Judges where it's talking about the... it says something to this effect. This is a loose paraphrase. That the people served the Lord through the life of Joshua and the lives of the elders who outlived Joshua. But then there came a generation that did not know the Lord and did not know His mighty acts for Israel. They were what? They were ignorant of what God had done. These people are too. These people are too. Verse 14, therefore Sheol enlarges his throat and opens wide its enormous jaws, and down to Zion's dignitaries, her masses, her crowds, and those who celebrate in her. Humanity is brought low. Each person is humbled, and haughty eyes are humbled. But the Lord is exalted by His justice, and the holy God shows that He is holy through His righteousness. Lambs will graze, and if in their own pastures, and the resident aliens will eat among the ruins of the rich. Talking about what the land is going to be like. A very vivid image of Sheol. Anybody know what Sheol is referring to? Kind of, but not totally. It's a place of the dead. It's a place of the dead. Actually, Sheol was thought of something like this. There would be a compartment on this side, a compartment over here. This in the New Testament became known as Hades. In the Greek word of Hades. Over here It was called Abraham's Bosom. Luke 16, Abraham's Bosom, Abraham's Side, however your translation renders it. And in between is a pit, a bottomless pit, a pit that is so deep, no one can cross over from one side to the other. Not possible. So on this side, you have the righteous dead. On this side, the unrighteous. And there's no going back and forth. Okay? So Sheol means both of these places. Basically the place of the dead. The righteous and the unrighteous. Now, most of the time when you think about Sheol, we tend to think more over here, the unrighteous. But it covers both the righteous and the unrighteous. And sometimes the translation of yesteryear was to refer to that Sheol equals hell. Not quite. Not quite. Now, when you get to the New Testament, it gets a little more specific, where the word Hades is used. Now, Hades is a place of the unrighteous dead. It's a Greek loan word. The concept is different than the Greek concept of Hades. I remember years ago, when I was in high school, there was a group that came to somewhat prominence, and they called themselves Styx, Styx. Not Styx like Styx, but that kind of Styx. And what is that? Well, it's the river that flows in Hades. You remember Jesus going to Caesarea Philippi, taking disciples with him to that cave, that place where Pan was worshipped? I showed you pictures of it, you know, when we talked about that some time ago, when it was in Matthew, where Pan was worshipped. That was thought to be, or believed to be, that cave was the gate to the underworld, to the gate of Hades. And Jesus calls it that. He says, upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of, not hell, but Hades will not prevail against it. So the word Hades, Sheol, has a lot more meaning than sometimes we think of it. A much more robust word than simply we sometimes think. So anyway, the idea there, you see the picture? It enlarges its throat. Can you see it kind of like some sort of monster? Maybe not the best word to choose, but something that this mouth is getting bigger, its throat is getting bigger, just swallowing more and more. That's the kind of imagery you should have. Okay, let's go on. The next woe. Verse 18. Woe to those who drag iniquity with cords of deceit and pull along sin with cart ropes. You get the picture? Remember, this is going to be hard for you, okay? It might even be painful for most of you. Now, if you were 5 years old, this would be a breeze. Use your imagination here. Because it is to conjure up and expand your imagination. Can you imagine? Here they have a rope to a cart full of sin. And they keep pulling it right along with them. They keep bringing it with them. That's what they're doing. Let that picture be in your mind, because that's the picture that's supposed to be there. They're dragging it right along with them. They're not forsaking it. They want it to go wherever they go. To those who say, verse 19, let him hurry up and do his work quickly so that we can see it. Let the plan of the Holy One of Israel take place so that we can know it. And now move into the next woe. This is probably the woe that you're most familiar with. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And just the ethically charged words here of what the people were doing. Now, that's the woe that we hear the most about. or we probably think of the most when we look at our own culture. Can you think of any examples where that which is evil is called good?
Abortion.
Ah!
Yes.
Abortion? Absolutely.
Homosexuality.
Yes. Almost everything that you can think of that is evil has been somehow transposed into being considered good today. It's a warning here. The warning is to those who would call evil good and good evil. Those who would change. And I know this sounds...
I ain't gonna say it.
I'm going to withhold that, and you're going to be grateful that I did. Okay? Any comments about verse 20? Let's move to the next woe. Number five. Woe to those who consider themselves wise and judge themselves clever. Woe to those who think they're wise. At least consider themselves to be wise and judge themselves as being clever. The arrogant ones. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and who are champions at pouring beer, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of justice. Strong words. Now we've revisiting something that we've already come across, talking about those in verse 11, that first, second woe actually, where they were in pursuit of beer and also lingering in the evening inflamed by wine. Again, that is mentioned. Let's talk about, if we can, just interject into this whole area of the use of alcohol. Okay? When I grew up, the little church that I grew up in, I kid you not, on the wall, posted there, was a church covenant. It was there. Then, in another church that I went to, it wasn't there, but it was pasted in the hymn book. It was there, the church covenant. You may know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Some of you will, some of you won't. Okay. All right. We need to approach this with wisdom and not being dogmatic at the same time. Did Jesus turn water into wine? That's what it says. He doesn't say he turned it into new wine. He doesn't say he turned it into grape juice. He said it turns it into wine. Okay. Also be aware that because of the quality of the water, sometimes wine was mixed with water to help in the water itself not causing you any kind of digestion issues. However, there was intoxicating drink that was available. What you need to be aware of is that the Bible speaks many different places on the abuse of alcohol, of intoxicating drink. As a matter of fact, drunkards are not destined for the kingdom of God, but for hell. It's what it says. As all liars and all this other thing, all these other kind of sinful patterns, that's one of them that's classified as that. Be aware of that. Paul does tell Timothy, if you've got a nervous stomach, buddy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. He said a little. When you come to the issue of church leadership, you'll find that in 1 Timothy, and Titus is echoed, but 1 Timothy is a little bit clearer here, that the bishop, the presbyteros, whatever you, overseer, however it's rendered, usually we call pastor, is not to be given to wine. He's just not. A king is warned not to be given to wine because he will forget what his decrees are and he will not rule justly. So, this is kind of hard, you know, to deal with, because it has, in our culture, it has such a place in it. You cannot watch a television program without people drinking. Not just, you know, lighter drinks, but heavier, you know, the more stronger stuff, the liquor. Does the Bible forbid drinking of any kind of alcoholic beverages? Well, no, it doesn't forbid it, but it warns about the abuse of it. Now, there's freedom here. But you've got to be careful. You've got to be careful with the freedom that you may have, because you don't know what's going to happen after that first drink. Just be careful. I'm not saying this as anything to take pride in. I have a very pragmatic reason for saying this. I have never. The only alcoholic beverage I ever took was cough syrup. Nothing beyond that. Nothing. I had a beer poured all over me once time because I had a Royals game and the gal behind me had too many and she poured it all down my back. And I was so sick at my stomach by the time I got home, back at seminary campus. I'm glad I didn't run into any of my professors. Because I smelled like, man. And it was hot. It was summertime watching the Royals game. Believe it or not, we could go out in left field where the sun was baking on you. $3 to get in to watch George Brett and also Bo knows. We'll watch them play ball. But it was great. $3, seminary students. We went down there. A whole pack of us would go down there. Sit there and bake in the sun and then get beer poured all over you. I'll tell you why, though. Why I've never touched it. And why I shall not ever touch it. I have alcoholics on both sides of my family. I have drunks on both sides of my family. I had a great uncle, my grandpa's brother. He could talk about moonshine and get drunk. I am not kidding you. He'd start talking about it, his tongue would get thick, he'd start slurring, his body would just kick into drunk, you know, kind of. When he was 17 years old, he was gone from home for about 3 days, and my great-grandfather knew where to go looking for him, so he went and found him at one of his drinking buddies who was off of Bull Creek. There's a still there or something. They had alcohol. They had been drinking for 3 days. And when my great-grandfather showed up, this other guy was dragging my great-uncle to the chop block. He was going to chop his head off because they were into an argument about something. So, I mean, I have them both sides. He's just one. There was a bunch more. Pragmatically, I don't want to do that. I just don't. I don't want to run the risk. If there is any kind of genetic component, I've got it, right? Be careful. The Scripture does not say that you cannot partake. But you better be careful. And just take that word of caution. If you've ever, and I have, if you've ever been with someone who has the DTs, you will never want to be around that stuff. Of course, the same thing with a drug addict that needs a fix. You'll see the same kind of reaction. The body craves it. The body hungers for it. And the body will punish the person until they get it. So be careful about those kind of things. Yes, there's freedom here. But be very, very careful. And that's just not in one area. It can be in a lot of areas of life. you know, one person could drink a glass of wine every day and never become an alcoholic. Another person could take that first drink and from then on the rest of their life. What's the guy's name at the Brooklyn Tabernacle?
Cimbala.
Yeah, Jim Cimbala. Cimbala, in his book, I think it's called Storm, talks about his dad. His dad was a teetotaler. He would not drink. He would not drink. He just always avoided it. And he worked, the company that he worked for, they had a Christmas party. And people were just shaming him and badgering him because he wouldn't drink. So he finally said, fine. So he did. He took a drink. And from then on, the rest of his life, he was almost always drunk. Because of the propensity that it was his to do that. Just, I guess you understand what I'm trying to say. Be careful with a lot of things. We may have we do have freedom. We have liberty. But Paul said, I'll never be in bondage to any of them. And if it causes, if my freedom causes a weaker brother or sister to stumble, I will curtail my freedom for their sake, for whom Christ died. Now, in the context he's talking about meat sacrificed to idols. But to someone who thinks that idol is, if you eat the meat that's been sacrificed to an idol, and if you do that, if you eat that, you are participating in the worship of that false god. If that's their perspective, you're going to cause them problems. You're going to cause them problems. And Paul says, just don't do it. Don't do it. I think we probably belabored that enough. Verse 24. Therefore, as the tongue of fire consumes straw, and as dry grass shrivels in the flame, so their roots will become like something rotten, and their blossoms will blow away like dust. For they have rejected the instruction of the Lord, and they have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the Lord's anger burned against his people. He raised his hand against them and struck them. You notice the past tense? You noticing it? Okay. That's that prophetic speaking about future events in the past tense. The mountains quaked, and their corpses were like garbage in the street. In all this, his anger was not turned away, and his hand is still raised to strike. Those are sobering words, aren't they? Those are sobering words. Now, I don't know, two or three times that I've read so far in the text, you are aware of this expression that is really somewhat unique in this sense, being used as many times as Isaiah uses it, opposed to other prophets, and that's the Holy One of Israel, or God with that adjective in front of the word God, holy. How important that word actually is, holy. We're going to understand more clearly why next time we get together and look at chapter 6. That event so set in the mind and the heart of Isaiah, he could not think of God without thinking of him as being holy. Holy. And we'll talk maybe more about that next time. But the idea of holiness, it's a churchy word. You're familiar with it. You probably on the spine of your Bible, you have the word there. And you know it means set apart, but it also means more than that. Holiness. Well, first, God's holiness. Then we'll talk about people, the holiness of God's people. Holiness, I think, is very difficult for us to imagine. we talk about the holiness of God. Something about holiness escapes us. Every explanation or every definition that we look at doesn't quite seem to capture what we're talking about, really. And I've heard me say this before. When we talk about the holiness of God, I want you to understand it's scary. It's frightening. Maybe those words are not strong enough. How about they're terrifying? Or horrifying? Just something about the holiness of God. Anytime the holy comes in contact with the mortal, it's scary. It's scary. When an angel appears, and the people there know that it's an angel that has appeared to them, they are really scared. What's one of the first things that an angel says when he appears?
Fear not.
Why? Because they're going to be afraid. They're going to be afraid. The holiness of an angel is nothing compared to the holiness of God. And the holiness of an angel is so frightening that the angel usually instructs the person, don't fear. Think about the Roman guard at the tomb. There's probably no better example than anything than those guys. The Roman guard, we're not talking about two guards standing there before by the stone. The Roman guard was a unit of Roman soldiers composed of 16 men, four of whom were awake at all times. And the remaining 12, in spoke-like fashion, would sleep with their heads in toward each other, right in front of the object that they're guarding. And the other four would be awake. All right? Well, when the resurrection takes place, the angel comes down and picks up the stone and gives it a toss. Tell me about those men. Now, these are not little weakling type people. They fall down like dead men. It's so scary that they pass out. They're that afraid, which is stunning when you think about it. That they're so afraid that they pass. John, in Revelation, he does it. He falls down. He's going to worship the angel because this is so otherworldly. What do? Well, you just fall down and worship. And the angel said, don't you dare do that. I'm a fellow servant. Worship God. Daniel does it in the book of Daniel. When Gideon's parents meet the angel and they realize it's an angel, Gideon's dad, Manoah, I believe it is, he told his wife, we're dead because we've seen God. And his wife, maybe a little more sensible, well, if he wanted to kill us, he would have. You know. But he was persuaded, we're dead. You see, Isaiah is so impacted by that that he just can't hardly refer to God without pointing out his holiness. Everything about God is holy. His righteousness is holy. His wrath is holy. His justice is holy. His love is holy. His hatred is holy. You follow? It's an adjective that goes, it covers everything. All that God is and does is holy. So much so that in heaven, that chorus is saying it over and over and over, holy, 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 thrice holy. In one manuscript, it's called the majority text, holy in Revelation is mentioned 9 times. 3 threes. Nine times mentioned how holy he is. I hope that helps at least to some degree. We got a couple minutes, a few minutes. Any questions or comments, anything you'd like to add? How are you going to know
what is true and what is false?
How are you going to know? Like verse 20. How are you going to know?
Compare it to the Lord, to what is the Lord.
Yeah, can you tell what is evil and what is good? You have to know by a standard outside of yourself. Are you following here? You have to have a standard. Okay. How close are you to that standard? If this is the standard, how do you know? Well, what we could do is I could say, well, here's Greg. Here I am. And thinking, well, Greg's a little bit better than me, so he must be better, more holy than I am. He's closer to the standard. But the problem is, none of us make it to up here. None of us meet the standard. So a lot of times what we do is we do a lot of comparison. I'm not an alcoholic. That counts, right? I can do all kinds of vices. Well, I'm not doing that. So for those people who are doing that, obviously I'm better, right? Well, it depends on what you mean. If you mean better than them, more moral than them, you can say, well, yeah, I guess so. But when you realize that no matter how good we are, we're still there. Maybe it could be all kinds of other people down in here, but we're still there. Here's the standard. So we need to be, very careful about trying to determine what is right and what is wrong. What is, as we see there, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. We need to be aware that sometimes even us can drift into sometimes thinking that something evil is maybe something that we practice. It may not be what we consider a huge sin, but it could be, one of the favorite hymns of a prayer chain. I love to tell the story. I'm just passing along information so you can pray better. Be careful when somebody asks that. You have a prayer request and they want to know all the details. It may not be their business to know the details. God knows the details. Just leave it with Him. Because sometimes we don't realize how evil that is. That's evil. It's probably spoken against more than a lot of other vices that we can think of. Being a gossip. I knew a gal years ago that sat in my office crying because of all the stuff that people would tell her that they were upset about. Things that they didn't like. Things that they wished they were different. It's church. It's church stuff. It's not anything else. It's church stuff. And she was there, and I said, her name was Beth. Beth, why do you suppose people tell you all of this junk? I guess because I'm a good listener. No, they don't. And I didn't know this story at the time, but later John Maxwell gave a story that was so wonderful to illustrate what Beth was doing, and I didn't realize it at the time, but later I did understand it more clearly.
He said, I want you to think about your life as a well-manicured lawn. All the weeds are out. It's edged. It's cut. It's watered. It's fertilized. It is beautiful. And you're standing there looking out your picture window, and you see a guy come walking or driving by, and he stops, and then he takes a bag of trash and throws it on your lawn. What are you going to do? You're probably going to knock the door down, getting out, and letting him know that you don't want that stuff on your well-manicured lawn. But Beth's lawn wasn't well-manicured. Beth's lawn had trash all over it. People would come and throw this bag of trash. They knew they could because she would take it. There in her yard. And so a guy driving by, he looks there and he sees all that. It's a dump. So he takes his bag of trash and throws it out there with all the other bags of trash. And you really can't tell where his bag of trash is because there's all those other bags of trash out there. And you've got a sign there. Your trash is welcome here. And that's what a lot of people do. They accept the trash. You know how to get rid of that? Someone tells you something disappointment, say, come on, let's go right now, let's go talk to so-and-so about it. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. No, if you really want to be biblical about it, you have an issue, go talk to the person you have the issue with. Go talk to them. And if you're not willing to go talk to them, you don't need to be talking to anybody about it. That make sense? Okay. So we have a tendency to do that kind of stuff. We always see the options. We forget that the standard is up here. It's not here. It's up here. And if you want to really understand it, just write the name Jesus right across there. There's the standard. There's the standard. Everything else doesn't come close. That's the standard. Okay? Alrighty then. You've been very kind to listen to all of that.